month. One for Dan, one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be in Australia.
Dead, buried, cremated.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
Just follow the money.
G'day, and welcome to our first Follow the Money summer special. If you're taking a break this summer, but you're still craving a political fix, we are here to help. We've got highlights from the Australia Institute's popular Politics in the Pub live sessions from earlier this year. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Australia Institute. And 2016, well, the best you can say about it is probably that it was interesting. We saw a populist right-wing sentiment strike back at the polls in what looks like a rejection of mainstream politics that's echoing right around the Western world. In the United Kingdom, Brexit was the first shock. Here in Australia, Pauline Hanson made a surprise comeback in the Australian Parliament. And of course, the year ended with Donald Trump winning the US election. Joining us in the pub for their take on 2016 politics are Rob Harris, the national political reporter for the Herald Sun, Daniela Retorto, the chief political correspondent for SBS News, Matthew Knott, federal political reporter for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, and Alice Workman, the political reporter for BuzzFeed. They're joining our executive director, Ben Oquist, in Canberra earlier this month.
Hello, everybody.
That's better.
That's your invitation not to say hello back, but to shut up.
Apologies for the difference in sound quality of our usual Follow the Money episodes. If it sounds like we recorded it in the pub, well, we did.
So, 2016 is coming to a close. I remember. that's a hopeful wish, isn't it? Somehow you think 2017 is going to be better.
When we had this time last year, I remember we were talking about will Malcolm bring in the GST? Will he use all that amazing political capital he has up his sleeve to bring in the GST? I think I said no. I think Alice said yes. So I
went,
I may have just made that up.
No, I think we both said no.
David Bowie was alive this time last year. Alan Richmond, God, what a sad year it's been. Malcolm had credibility. really, an incredible year, really. 8-week election campaign. I think my favourite story of the year was really Barnaby Joyce becoming Deputy PM, because who would have thought, and it really put the lunatics in charge of the asylum. And it really went downhill from there. It's been a really interesting year. Politics across the world, I suppose, has been interesting this year when you, it's almost the rise of the deplorables, and it's not just Donald Trump, it was Brexit as well and One Nation. So we've seen a, I don't know whether it's a shift in the political landscape or whether it's just modern day politicians forgot how to be politicians and probably took people for granted a bit. I think that there's probably a bit of truth in both of those things. In terms of predictions for next year, I mean, I think I'm out of the prediction game because it's all just a bit nuts now. So, yeah, it's been a fascinating year. It's been a great year to be in the gallery. We spent 8 weeks, most of us spent about 8 weeks on a bus.
Nine.
Following Bill and Malcolm around, and at least one of us wanted to jump out a window on election evening and probably thought seriously about it at one stage, but we're here. We may have a reshuffle ahead of us. I think Alice might talk a bit more about that in a minute.
Thanks, Rob. Danielle.
Hi, everyone. For me, if I think about 2016, for me, I think there was a pivotal moment, and it came at exactly the halfway point. And for me, it was election night and the Prime Minister's bizarre and rambling speech on the night after midnight. And I remember standing there, I had my shoes off at that point, I'd been standing on the box, ready to cross live for about 2 hours because he was well overdue. Where's Malcolm? What's going on? And for me, that moment and that speech said two things. It said all of the frustrations of the man up until that point, so that how that first 6 months of this year just didn't go well for him. He had spent and burnt that political capital that he had when he took over, and I thought the result being so precarious and so unknown was a disaster for him. And then if you pivot from that 6 months, the last 6 months, it's really shaped, I think, this political year. He hasn't been able to get that flow, that momentum. That night he sounded like the man who lost, and I think that's almost carried in his posture ever since. So for me, election night, for more reasons than one, was what I think shaped this year. And that speech, I think, for me, has summed up the two halves of this year.
Yeah, that speech was a cracker, wasn't it?
when he threatened to call the cops, basically, on Labor. And he still, I think, well, we can't give away too much, but he still hasn't really...
It's still raw.
He's still, if you do get the chance to talk to him, he'll still cheer you off for about half an hour.
I had a memory also from the election campaign, which was about a week before Daniela's. It was at Devonport Bowls Club, which you shouldn't miss. It's been renovated with a $1.2 million grant from the federal government. And we were there because this was being announced, but it was the day of Brexit, so all journalists, we were all on our phone. Of course, we still expected that the result would be Remain, but everyone was checking their phone, and we were there in Devonport Bowls Club waiting for the PM to arrive, and it was becoming clear that Britain was going to leave, and none of the people who were in, without being ageist in any way, there weren't many other smartphones around among the people who were there, so they didn't know, so we knew that this massive global event was happening and that the world was going to change and the pound was crashing, and Malcolm Turnbull got up to give his speech about the renovation to the bowls club. And he said, just to let you know, it looks like Britain's leaving the EU, and there was this sudden intake of breath. And that, I think we all went home and we were all talking about it that night, about how the world is going to change and how the experts have got it so wrong. And that was a theme that was played out again in the US election, was that we didn't see this coming. And I think when I think about journalists and political journalists, it's a year of a lot of soul searching and questioning about how many experts and pollsters, not here but around the world, got things so wrong, which is a problem for you given you've come here to listen to political journalists. But we're all questioning how effective the things are we do. You look at, you know, say the New York Times did all these amazing stories about Donald Trump and his taxes, and it seems that it really didn't have a big effect on the outcome. So it's probably not bad for journalists to have a bit of humility and to be questioning how we do our jobs in the political arena.
It's so funny that you say that. I got a lot of phone calls from Rob Harris where he rants at me. And
really?
One of the most memorable this year was when he called me and he said, Malcolm Turnbull is holding a press conference during Usain Bolt's race. I mean, how out of touch is this man? And I think that summarised a lot of what all of us are trying to say. Is that okay that I mentioned that? So I didn't run this past Rob.
Look, Usain Bolt, it's the 200 metres final. Goes for less than 20 seconds. And Malcolm Turnbull, 3 minutes before the race, decides to go into a sort of a press conference. And I was outraged because everyone in the office decided to turn over the TV to watch Malcolm. And I had to find a TV in the corner. I was very angry about it.
Yeah.
Was it about Medicare?
Jobs and growth.
Can you remember what he's talking
about? That's the thing, we can't even remember. But I'll tell you what, Usain Bolt won one gold. I don't know that much.
I think that's it. I was just going to say that my hot take of the year is that unless things dramatically change for Malcolm, I think that history, or, you know, maybe conservative historians, will say that Tony Abbott was a better Prime Minister than Malcolm Turnbull.
Ouch.
And achieved more. And I think
Jared
that...
Henderson.
Yeah, maybe Jared would say that. Yeah, and I think that that kind of summarises a lot of feelings about his leadership choice and his leadership style, which is, I think, pandering too much to the backbench, not giving his opinion enough, not pushing his own agenda, pitching ideas and then dropping them days later. And generally, you know, if you look at the polling where he is now, there's no way that he could turn around tomorrow and suddenly come out and say, well, yeah, I want to do an ETS or I want to be a Republic, because he'd be crucified for it. But he could have done it at the beginning when his polling was really great. But his polling is dismal at the moment. So, and, you know, no one would have thought a year ago when we were here that we would be saying, well, Malcolm's prime ministership is really on the rocks, but can we overthrow another PM? Like, who knows? Maybe that'll happen next year.
And do you think that's, any one of you, that's something to do with attempting to overlearn the lessons from the last prime ministership and kind of make the reverse problems, the listening to the backbench too much, not leading enough, so attempting to learn the mistakes of Tony Abbott, but over in the other direction?
Absolutely. think that you can fundamentally see that in the way that he runs his office and runs his negotiations. Abbott had a very small liaison team with the backbench, one or two people. Malcolm's got one that's about 10 people. But he regularly over-consults, I would say, to the point where, you know, you could say quite accurately that, you know, Tony Abbott and Peter Credlin ran a very tight kind of captain's call ship. And you couldn't, you know, even staffers that worked in other ministerial offices couldn't get phone calls returned from the Prime Minister's office. They would call them asking questions and they would not call them back. And it's the exact opposite now, but I think maybe to his detriment.
I disagree totally with you, Alison. I don't think there's any problem with the backbench running the government at all. In fact, the first spill against Tony Abbott, that empty chair spill, as we now refer to it now in I think it was February last year, was a peasants' revolt. It was completely the backbench doing it because he wasn't listening to them. Yeah, everyone's going, oh, Malcolm's going to get overthrown. I mean, they haven't got a reason to overthrow him. He's given them everything they want, you know, and he hasn't yet asked for anything in return. I think the problem may be when he does ask them for something in return, and that we may get onto that a bit later. But I think we're being very breathless. I think he's still ahead. You know, he is still a preferred Prime Minister over Bill. We're a long way from the next election. He won election less than 6 months ago, so I think you should just ease up on that. Enjoy some mince pies instead.
I might just want to add, it's 2016, the year we finally give up on the polls, right? Like, I'm sick of polling. We're obsessed with it in this country. The fortnightly news poll and the way it drives the media cycle drives me bonkers. The polls have got it wrong on so many levels. We've heard about shy Brexiteers and shy Trumpers, and I'm over polls. That's my take of 2016.
I kind of disagree with Rob a bit in that I think one thing you see in Parliament House working every day is just, regardless of what we think of him as a communicator or even his policies, is just what an effective politician Bill Shorten is and how effective his operation is at constantly getting on the front foot with the message. Even when the Turnbull government has good news to announce, it's 4 hours behind the schedule and someone else has already claimed credit for it before they've been able to. So just on the pure politics of it, I think Malcolm is still learning a lot about what it means to be a politician.
I think Matt's right with that. They are very bad at politics. The other thing, I think, is that incumbency has become a burden where it used to be an advantage in politics. So I think now, and we've seen with so many one-term governments at state level, people just don't really forgive the people in power there, and they're very willing to vote a government out. And basically, you know, we've seen almost, you know, three or four governments now in a row sort of voted out in many aspects, you know. It's very hard once you get in power. It's almost easier to be in opposition.
Anyone got any ideas of when and why that happened? It's become easier to break something than fix something. And the whole idea of being able to set the agenda as a government and be able to announce things on your own term. Is it a global thing? Is it an Australian thing? And when and why did that happen?
So I was away from Australia for the last 5.5 years, and I came back this year and back to Australian politics, and the thing I've noticed the most is the speed. It is breakneck speed in terms of the news cycle, in terms of how much happens every day. I don't know if there's any way to slow it down, but I mean, it's partly our fault. If there's not a reaction or a statement from a minister within hours or, you know, minutes, we're saying, oh, they were slow to react, and, you know, more than a day after that happened, did they finally come out with a statement? And so I don't know if it's partly our fault, the way we've fragmented and the speed of online journalism, which is amazing in so many ways, rather than, you know, one deadline a day, say for me in TV, I'm now expected as much as anyone else to break news on the go. And I know for me, it doesn't give me much time to think, right? I'm just reporting without thinking. And I wonder if politicians feel that same pressure. They're just reacting without thinking.
We're still probably in the era of the Abbott opposition, which Tony Abbott started, and Bill Shorten has followed the model that he developed, which is to oppose pretty much anything, even if it doesn't coincide with your own views. And you've seen him having these philosophical regrets about maybe they should have backed the Malaysia solution years later, and the backpacker tax was the classic example. I mean, Labor didn't care about backpackers at all, but if you could cause damage to the government, where that is the... And that's so effective for the opposition, and Tony Abbott showed it was effective, and Bill Shorten has shown it's effective. The question is, when you come in, it's just going to be just as hard for you to govern.
Yeah. I would just say that the other example of that would be same-sex marriage, which was just an absolute example of people refusing to work together and just being self-indulgent and ridiculous. The fact that the Labour and the Greens both decided they opposed the plebiscite but refused to return each other's phone calls. And so we had, within a week, five different people introduce their own same-sex marriage bill to Parliament. It's absolutely absurd.
Yeah.
My answer to your first question should have been, my biggest takeaway from 2016 was the photo shoot that Matthew facilitated with George Christensen in a singlet, which changed my life. And I have a question for you, Matthew. Were you there when he took his shirt off?
Did anyone see that photo?
We've talked about Malcolm Turnbull and his bad year, but who's had good years? A lot of failures and flops nationally, internationally, but whose status has been enhanced and who do you see as an enduring figure from 2016?
Well, to just take Alice's lead, I don't think George would have thought he'd be on the cover of any magazine ever. So maybe he has had a good year. I wasn't there when he did the photo, but I did know that he had this tattoo. Some Nat had mentioned it to me, that he has a tattoo that you want to see, and I saw it beneath his white shirt one day, and I said, oh, you know, what's your tattoo about? And he showed it to me, and I said, no, I've got a tattoo too, you know, it's not the Virgin Mary, but it's a wanky quote in Spanish, so we didn't have that much in common. But,
you had to show him yours to get him to show you his, or?
No, he just showed me his, and he showed me the photos, and I said to our photographer, this, you know, we want this photo. And I remember him calling me and he said, I'm at Big W Woden and I'm looking for a 4XL singlet to put in there. And he said, I can't believe he's going to do it, but he's agreed to do it. So, yeah.
Has he had any regrets? Is he happy about it?
He says that he wouldn't do it again, given all the memes, but he also really enjoyed it and they've asked for a copy to put on the wall of the elected office, so I think he liked it. And again, it fed into the fact that everyone was making fun of him for it, feeds into that narrative which Pauline Hanson also benefits from, which is that we are the victims of the sneering elite classes, which make of that what you want.
Anybody else want to talk about other winners from 2016 and potentially those that might endure beyond 2016?
Regardless of your political views, I'd say Bill Shorten has had a hell of a year. He went from Mr. Nobody unelectable to carrying on after the election like he'd won and doing these kind of bizarro shopping tours and patting everyone on the back. And for me, it comes down to posture, and he's behaved like a winner. So he lost the election, but he's behaved like a winner. And I think in politics, it's perception. Most of it is a confidence trick. Now, whether he can carry that on, whether he's got enough policies behind him, and Labour has remained united while looking on an upward trajectory. But let's not forget, there is divided below the surface as the other more.
I think that's right. I mean, it's easy to forget that we're talking about replacing billions of February this year. In some quarters. Do you remember he crashed his mum's car while drinking coffee?
Oh, was he in the car?
Yeah, and then he got caught texting and driving. And
talking about lettuce, your favourite.
And talking about lettuce, yeah. So, I mean, things can obviously turn very quickly in politics. There's no doubt the Crossbench have probably been winners this year in terms of Nick Xenophon. And Nick has been an incredible politician and will continue to be. The interesting thing about Nick, as we saw with Darren Hicks in the last week, Darren Hicks really disgraced himself in the last week and has cost himself a lot of capital, because the one thing that happens now with cross-match negotiations is nobody talks to Jackie Lambie anymore. The government doesn't brief Jackie Lambie because she's been so outrageous and books meetings, doesn't turn up to meetings, argues with them, is irrational. So they don't even deal with her anymore. They don't brief her. They basically forget that she exists. So she very rarely gets anything in return. And the smart thing that Nick Xenophon, even Pauline Hanson, and certainly David Layman have done, is that every opportunity they listen to the government and then try and work with them when they can. And Darren Hicks probably almost cost himself that in the last week when he picked a fight on the backpacker tax that he really wasn't even interested in. Yeah, so look, I think the crossroads, I think Pauline Hanson has probably surprised people with her ability to deal with the government, to work with the government, and they have a reasonable working relationship.
Rob Cullors is an interesting character, so I don't know, he's quite a winner. We always want him to hang on just because he's so exciting. But I think probably the crossbench, apart from Bill, have been big winners this year. And Barnaby Joyce obviously became Deputy PM, and they no doubt have George Christensen and a lot of others. They're certainly exerting a bit of influence to at government level.
Alice, have you got a winner from 2016 or one that you think is going to survive?
You know, it's funny because I would have said Bill Shorten up until probably a month after the election. Bill Shorten, I generally regard as a pretty lazy politician. I don't think he's that exciting in Parliament. He never kind of does anything to impress. And then, in comparison, I was so impressed during the election campaign. I was on Shorten's bus more than Turnbull's bus, and I was just every day pretty much blown away by it. Like, to see his potential and to see him be the politician that he should be every day. And he held that for a while after the election, like Danielle was saying. He was the winner of the election. And then now I think, unfortunately, he's returned to being a pretty lazy opposition leader, unfortunately. I would say...
Can you explain that?
Yes.
Give us an example.
Is it because he stopped running?
I think he's still running. I see him running in Canberra sometimes. No, what I mean is that I think that he waits. A good politician will be forthright in their opinions, they'll be stronghold in their opinions. He, I think, waits for the government to step up and then steps up. And he knows that that's a winning tactic, which is totally fine. If that's the strategy he wants, then good on him. But I talk to people who aren't as in the bubble as we are, and I think that they say, well, what has Bill Shorten done? Like, what has he achieved? What opposition is he actually offering up, which is exciting? Where's the progression? Where's the kind of interesting place that we should be working towards? And I know that a lot of Labour people at the moment are saying that Bill's very worried about a mounting leadership challenge. And he should be. He should be worried. Let's be honest. He should be worried. Like, we're in election mode already.
Imagine just getting through 1 year without a leadership challenge at either side.
So I was going to say my winner, from a voter's perspective, might be Pauline Hanson, because if you want to look at the way that who you voted for and how they've achieved for you, I would say that people that voted her probably think they've gotten the best out of any other politician because their issues are in the spotlight. She's, you know, forefront in negotiations. Xenophon and Hinch have, I think, really underwhelmed me because rather than getting any kind of actual policy or amendment changes in the legislations that they've been involved in, they've gotten, you know, working party groups and these really kind of piss-sweet things from the government as opposed to actual incentives or actual kind of, you know, compromises. But I would say that Pauline Hanson is the winner because their issues are out there now. People are talking about them. And, you know, whilst we may not trust polling, it is indicating that, you know, in this Trump post-truth world, the silent majority of people who believe that the current mainstream politicians aren't representing them, whether because they're moving to the centre or because no one's ever been an option for them, maybe they voted for Pauline 20 years ago, who knows, they're like making a comeback, right? And I think that maybe the media is to blame for that.
When you talk about Hanson, Pauline Hanson during the election campaign hardly got any mainstream press apart from her
sunrise.
Apart from her sunrise appearances. But what she does do now is basically doesn't deal with newspapers at all, will deal occasionally with the ABC. But she puts up a video on Facebook and it gets watched by 2 million people.
Oh, more than 2 million.
There you go. So she has the ability to just put her message out there unfiltered, and she got 4 senators by doing so. So maybe it's the media that are the big losers of this year. Because really, I mean, every editorial backed Malcolm in, bar
and Hillary.
And Hillary, bar a couple, and they all look like idiots again. I probably shouldn't say that about my own organisation, or about my own profession, but it's certainly the way I feel at the end of it. I think the media's relevance is sinking all the time.
So to summarise it, the winner of the year, Pauline Hanson, the losers of the year, the press.
Yeah. How depressing.
That's been episode 12 of Follow the Money, brought to you by the Australia Institute. Thank you very much to Rob Harris from the Herald Sun, Daniela Retorto from SBS News, Matthew Knott from the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, and Alice Workman from BuzzFeed for such a great night. We've put their Twitter handles in the podcast show notes on the Australia Institute's website at tai.org.au/podcasts, where you can also find links to all the previous episodes of Follow the Money. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, and if you enjoyed it, please share it with friends or leave a rating on iTunes. It helps other people to find it. If you live in Canberra and would like to see one of our Politics in the Pub live events, you can sign up on our mailing list at tai.org.au. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy. Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum composed our title track, and you can find more of his music at pulseandthrum.com. Please stay tuned. We've got more of the best Politics in the Pub sessions coming up over the next few weeks. Thanks for listening.